two living humans could be anyone, from anywhere. Can you describe the humans to me? I asked.
One of them is quite wrinkly, Cowrie said. The male's body is rather mottled and purple.
He's purple? I asked.
Cobb was injured, Alanique said. When I saw him on the superiority ship, he looked like he'd been in a fight. Yes, the large gentleman with the hairy face has some wounds we're trying to attend to, but we don't know much about human physiology. I still need someone to explain that lip hair to me, Alanique said. It seems problematic. We would like to return your humans to you for medical attention, Cowrie said. We have been to the location of your planet, but we don't have a hyperdrive to reach you. We were able to stow away on a carrier ship to return home from Starsight, but stealing a ship of that size is beyond our abilities. Do you have access to a hyperdrive?
Alanique and I exchanged a look. Winzik already knew we had hyperdrives, so giving that away wouldn't be terrible. We have transportation, I said.
That is most fortuitous, Cowrie said. We look forward to making your acquaintance. Though Spensa deceived us, we found her to be a most honorable and formidable warrior, and we look forward to meeting with her peers, if indeed she has any.
I wasn't sure if I should be offended by that or not.
Are we going to go? Alanique asked quietly. I still think it's suspicious that I can't find Gran-Gran on their planet.
I hesitated. We hadn't said we would go, but if they had Gran-Gran and Cobb, we had to do everything in our power to retrieve them. It was a risk, but without taking risks, we'd never be able to find more allies. I muted the microphone. Sir, I said to Stoff, I would like to send a small group to investigate. If we control the destination of our hyperjump, we should be able to scan the area for superiority presence before we're spotted. According to Section 14 of the DDF statutes on prisoners of war, if a commander is missing behind enemy lines, it should be considered an implied order to rescue that commander if it does not directly interfere with the current mission. In this case, I'd say the section applies. I agree, Stoff said. I think you should accompany your flight and investigate the situation. I blinked at him. I wanted to go. I never wanted to send my flight anywhere without me. Even staying behind when they returned to Redon had been difficult. Stoff knew that. Did he want me to go because he knew I was watching him? Alanique and I were the DDF's only Cytonics. They needed us, so they should be reticent to send us both away at once. But old prejudices ran deep. They were still afraid of us. So sending us away on a mission, one they could either take credit for if it was a success, or scapegoat us for if it was a failure, probably seemed like a convenient excuse to get us out of the way. If it meant we'd get Cobb back, though, it worked in our favor. Yes, sir, I said. I'll get my team ready. Stoff nodded. Better tell them you're coming, then. I think it would be better if we don't, I said. If it is a trap, they'll have less time to prepare. All right, Stoff said. But you'll want to hurry. If Cobb and Mrs. Nightshade need medical attention, we'll want to get it to them sooner rather than later. Agreed. I unmuted the microphone. We will try to make arrangements to retrieve our people, I told Cowrie. We thank you for your patience.
We look forward to making your acquaintance, human, Cowrie said. May the stars guide you.
And you, I said. I hoped Kuna was right, that the Kitsin would make excellent allies. But at the moment, I would settle for having Cobb back, healthy and well. Chapter 5. When my flight hyperjumped near the coordinates we'd gotten from the hypercom, we appeared in space around a large, bluish-white planet. A blinding star illuminated most of this side of it. Far away, but still much larger and closer than I'd ever seen a star before. The planet was huge, even from this far out, and the whitish parts of it were moving across the surface, bubbling and roiling. Clouds, I realized. Collections of moisture that would rain down periodically, I'd read about them, but I'd never imagined them looking so fluffy. They looked almost soft, like cotton, not like water at all.
"Ooh, that's pretty," Sadie said.
"Gorgeous," Kimmelin said. "And I'm reasonably certain at first glance it isn't going to eat us."
The rest of the flight detached and separated into wingmate pairs, with the medical transport ship sticking close to me. The flight adopted a wedge formation around us, with Arturo and Ned taking point, FM and Sadie on one side, T-Stall and Catnip on the other, and the rest following. "Can we fly through all of that?" I asked. Our starfighters were airtight, of course, but I still wouldn't expect all the systems to function perfectly underwater. This water wasn't solid, though. It was more like steam rising from a boiling pot. Did that mean it would be scalding to touch? "Our ships can handle extremes in temperatures," I said. "So even if they're hot..."
"The clouds are not hot,"
Kuna said, sounding amused. They were riding with FM in the Dulo. We'd brought them along to help with diplomacy.
"The atmospheric pressure allows the water to remain in its gaseous state at a low temperature."
"Huh. Okay."
"I think it should be fine," Alanique said. "Your ships handled the miasma, didn't they? It's just a different type of gas."
"Right. That made sense. Still," I said, "I think we should try to fly through the gaps between them. Visibility would be limited in the clouds, and who knew what might be lurking within them. They shouldn't be too difficult to avoid. Large swaths of the atmosphere were clear, showing through to a brilliant blue-green surface. More water. An ocean. Stars. I'd read about those too, but I'd never been able to quite picture so much water. It sounded terrifying to live on a planet covered in that much water. How could you be sure it wasn't going to wash over everything and swallow it?" I zoomed my proximity monitors way out, searching for other spacecraft or aircraft, but I couldn't find any around the planet. If there were ships, they must be much closer to the planet's surface. So far, this didn't seem like a superiority trap, given the lack of cytonic inhibitors and enormous battleships, but we couldn't rule out that they might have changed their tactics. A signal came through the comms, a local radio transmission trying to reach me. I switched over. "This is Skyward One, call sign Jerkface," I said.
"Human,"
a tiny voice said. It sounded like Kauri, though I wasn't confident I'd be able to tell Kitson voices apart.
"Welcome to the den of everlasting light, which laps gently upon the shores of time. We will send you a heading to meet us on the burrow from which spring dreams both sweet and sorrowful."
I said. Boomslug repeated. "Thank you," I said. "We look forward to making your acquaintance." Scud. I'd listened to enough political pleasantries in my life. Why could I never remember them when I needed them? Kauri gave us the coordinates, and I instructed the flight to head toward them in formation. We flew down into the atmosphere of the planet and through a large gap in the clouds. As we neared the enormous blue-green expanse, I began to be able to pick out landmasses, large islands of broken land that looked almost like crumbled pie crusts at this distance. The coordinates led us to one particularly large island, and we flew over some rock formations weathered into bulbous pillars, the stone worn into the same geometric shapes over and over, like a castle made out of sand. The coordinates marked a spot on the far side of the island where one edge of the land met the ocean. The water below us was moving, the blue-green edged with white seafoam where it met the beach. Waves. I remembered learning about those. They were caused by wind and something to do with a moon, I thought, though I didn't see one of those at the moment. The sky was a wide swath of blue from down here, dotted with clouds. The sun too bright to look at without squinting. A ship, slightly larger than our fighters, waited for us on the beach. I reached out to Alanik, who flew in front of me. "Do you sense any inhibitors?"
"No," she said. "Still no cytonics either, though I think that ship has a tanix."
That would make sense if they had a hypercom. These aliens had managed to steal a superiority Tanix, which was impressive. It also showed initiative, a good trait in allies. We couldn't be expected to protect every species in the galaxy when we could barely protect ourselves. We cruised in for a landing on the sand, and I used my ship's air quality monitor to check the levels of oxygen in the atmosphere. The air appeared to be breathable, and there were no alerts about any noxious gases like the miasma on Redon. I landed my ship within sight of the other vessel, and the rest of my flight landed around me. I waited until we were all on the ground before opening my canopy. The ocean, I discovered, was scudding loud, like it was being run by a starfighter engine. The water rushed toward us, the peaks of the waves rising and then receding, like an arm reaching for something it couldn't quite grasp. I didn't understand how it moved like that, as if it were alive, and it made me wish I'd paid more attention when they taught us about old Earth. I climbed out of my ship, and the members of my flight joined me one by one. Though we should have been focused on the ship and watching for ambushes over the strange, layered sandstone cliffs that lined the beach, I noticed mine weren't the only eyes on the ocean. I turned toward a flurry of motion over by the Kitson ship, shielding my eyes from the blinding sun. A group of rodents was moving toward us, the one in front floating on a disc about the size of a dinner plate, a small acclivity stone craft, I was guessing. Most of the rodents were wearing flight suits, but the floating one wore a red and gold uniform and had a furry head with a set of enormous ears that looked something like the pictures of foxes from old Earth, though I thought foxes were bigger. These creatures were around 20 centimeters tall. But they were coming toward me from a starship, standing on two legs and wearing clothes, so I turned around, looking for Alanique. She was already walking up behind me. The sand seemed to slip from under her feet as she walked, making the trip laborious. "These are Kitson?" I asked her.
"Yes," she said. "I've never met one, but I learned about the species before I left for Starsight. They have a dynastic culture, I believe."
Dynastic? That seemed so primitive, like something out of Spence's stories. Farther back on the sand, I could see Kuna and FM climbing out of the Dulo, which had landed next to the medical transport ship we'd brought along for Cobb and Grangran. The Kitson were growing closer now, and the robed one on the floating platform raised a paw clenched into a fist, like they were angry with me. I wasn't the most qualified person to establish diplomatic relations, but I had been the one talking to Kauri over the radio. "Hello," I called. "Are you Kauri?"
"Yes, human," the Kitson said.
She had a translator pin affixed to the front of her uniform like a brooch.
"I am Kauri."
She floated up in front of us on her dinner plate while the rest of her crew clambered over the sand behind her.
"I am the captain of the Swims Against the Current in a Stream Reflecting the Sun, and I welcome you to our planet." "All their names are like that," Alanique said quietly beside me. "The superiority shortens the name of their planet to Evershore."
The Kitson's ears twitched, and I wondered if this was an offensive term given to them by their oppressors.
"That is very astute, Alanique," Kauri said. "Indeed, you may call it that if you wish."
"Evershore," I said, glancing at the ocean again. "That seems fitting." Though Alanique seemed somewhat alarmed that the Kitson knew her by name.
"Thank you, human," Kauri said.
"You're a friend of Spence's?" I asked. "But you knew her as Alanique." Alanique seemed to relax a bit. It was probably disconcerting to meet people who felt they knew you, but didn't quite. FM and Kuna trudged up beside us. I was glad I could use their help.
"Yes, I know Spencer," Kauri said. "I was hoping to see her again after her disappearance from Starsight. Is she well?"
I didn't know if Spencer was well, but I had to believe she was. "She's on a mission to learn more about the Delvers."
"Ah, yes," Kauri said. "We were there when Winzik summoned the Delver. a nasty decision, and what I fear he intends to repeat.
FM and I exchanged a look. If this ship, Stars, it would be a whole battleship to them, given their comparative size, was there in the battle with the Delver, then the Kitson had been fighting on the other side.
Which one of you is the human jerkface?
Kaori asked. Scud, I'd forgotten to introduce us. Sorry, I said. That's me. I'm Flight Leader Jorgen Waite. This is Alanik of the Urdale, and this is Minister Kuna.
It's a pleasure to meet you, Kuna said. Your people are quite advanced for a lesser species, and have been very close to acceptance into the superiority. I hope that we will be able to help you continue to advance as we consider what is best for all of your species.
Kuna raised their fist in the air with this pronouncement, in a similar greeting to the one Kaori had given me, though Kaori did not look impressed. Alanik shot me a look. Kuna really had to stop announcing that they found every species we met to be beneath them. We brought them along to help with diplomacy, but I didn't want it to seem like they spoke for all of us. And this is FM, I said. She's our diplomatic specialist. FM's mouth fell open. I raised an eyebrow at her, questioning whether she was going to argue with me. I probably should have put her in charge of this interaction to begin with. I'd been too busy avoiding her to think of it, which meant I was letting my own personal feelings get in the way of my job. That had to stop.
Thank you for the invitation to your beautiful planet, FM said. That rock formation we passed over on our way in, was that a city?
Kuna bared their teeth in one of their strange smiles, which I thought meant they were okay with FM taking the lead. Whether they were okay with it or not, it was clearly necessary.
Yes, Kaori said. The burrow from which spring dreams both sweet and sorrowful. You may call it Dream Spring, if you wish.
Dream Spring, FM said. That's beautiful. I would love to see more of it.
And I would love to share it with you, Kaori said. But we must be careful. Not all of my people will welcome your... Oh, how unfortunate.
She looked up at something in the sky over my shoulder, and I turned to see another starship approaching. This one had a startling number of guns mounted on the front, far too many to be tactically effective.
Humans, said a Kitson voice through a loudspeaker on the ship. Your invasion stops here. You shall not step one more foot into the beauty of the burrow from which spring dreams both sweet and sorrowful. We will cut you down where you stand.
Scud. I took a step backward, taking shelter against my ship, and FM and Alanik joined me. If that ship let loose its destructors, we were dead, all of us. The rest of the flight scattered, ducking beneath wings and jumping back into ships.
It's all right, Kaori said. That's Goro. I will speak with him.
He said he was going to cut us down, I said. I don't think that implies a lot of talking.
Yes, Kaori said. And he wonders why the superiority thinks we're primitive.
The other ship didn't fire, but instead began to lower itself onto the sand. Bits of grit blew in our direction, and I shielded my eyes. A host of Kitson poured out of the ship, all of them wearing tiny suits of power armor and carrying guns no longer than my hand. That made them enormous to a Kitson, though. And they all wore tiny metal helmets with a visor over their eyes and holes cut out for their ears. That seemed somewhat impractical. I wondered if they used their ears to regulate their temperature like some animals did back on old Earth. Or perhaps their ears grew back and were therefore seen as expendable. In the air above them, riding on another dinner plate-sized platform, was a large Kitson wearing richly ornamented plate armor that looked like something out of another century entirely. His helmet had curved horns jutting out of it, so large that they almost reached the tips of his ears. Oh, Spensa would really have loved this.
Scudballs,
I heard Arturo say.
Oh, dear, Kuna said. Such aggression.
I couldn't argue with that. The Kitson swiftly marched across the sand. More of my flightmates climbed back into their ships.
Since we were currently being flanked by what amounted to rats with rifles, I didn't blame them. I supposed I should give orders to my flight, but I didn't have any better idea what to do in this situation than they did. FM stayed by my side, Alanik and Kuna a step behind. Kaori rotated her platform to float between us and the oncoming Kitsune, though her other people mostly seemed to be getting out of the way. Since they were both unarmed and unarmored, I didn't blame them either.
Goro, Kaori said, what are you doing?
We intercepted your transmission, traitor, Goro said. You invited these treacherous giants onto our planet. Bad enough that any of their kind are being permitted to sully our sands. We should have blown them out of the sky when they first appeared.
No one is getting blown out of the sky, Kaori said. These are friends of a friend.
She looked over her shoulder at me.
Aren't you?
Yes, I said.
Other Kitsune, FM said. I am a diplomatic representative from our people.
I barely heard her add, apparently, under her breath.
We're here to collect our lost friends and discuss an alliance. We're not invading anything, and we don't mean to sully your sands.
This is heresy, Goro shouted, pointing a furry finger at me. He had quite a loud voice for such a small creature. We will not be fooled by your gilded words. The den of everlasting light which laps gently upon the shores of time has seen the last of your tyranny, and we will not suffer it again.
I'm sorry about him, said a voice near my feet, and I looked down to see that one of Kaori's people had scurried over to join us. Goro has a tendency toward the dramatic.
It's understandable, Kuna said. Your culture is not yet advanced enough to move beyond these aggressions. FM sighed and ignored Kuna, addressing the Kitsune at my feet. She had little white tufts at the ends of her ears and a brownish one at the end of her bushy white tail.
What's your name?
She asked.
Hana,
the Kitsune said.
Hi, Hana, FM said. I'm FM. Your people have interacted with humans before? When the first wave of humans conquered the galaxy, they started with us, Hana told her. Our ancestors fought bravely, but they were no match for human technology. And it didn't help that at first they welcomed the humans to our shores, the kindly giants straight out of legend. The tales of our early interactions through the nowhere had been passed down for generations.
Goro's soldiers had stopped about 3 meters from Kaori, but their tiny Kitsune leader floated his platform up until he stood toe-to-toe with her. I demand that you step aside, he said.
I will not, Kaori said. I contacted the humans so they could collect their lost people. They aren't invading, and there is no need for all of this.
She gestured at the Kitsune soldiers, whose power armor hummed ominously. The Kitsune hummed with it. It was probably meant to seem intimidating. It was working. Very well, Goro said. If they claim to come in peace, they must prove it by the sword. A sword? I supposed that might be preferable to being shot at by many tiny rifles, but why? Send forth one of your people, Goro continued, and they may duel my champion in honorable combat. Champion? I said. A single warrior stepped out of the mass of Kitsune. Her power armor was decorated by a tiny skirt, and her helmet curved into 2 wicked points underneath her chin. She was carrying a sword slightly longer than a dinner knife, which made it taller than she was. I looked at FM, but she was staring at the Kitsune champion. Kuna was watching us all with wide eyes, like they couldn't believe they had deigned to be present for so much barbarity. On this particular point, I had to agree, though it wasn't the barbarity that alarmed me so much as the practical concerns. A sword? Really? We're not fighting that, I said. No way. I'll fight it, Ned called from behind me, and FM shot him a withering look.
We don't want to fight anyone, FM said. We're here on a mission of peace.
Our people have also been oppressed by the superiority, and...
A chortling sound came from the kitson. Stars, were they laughing?
You call it oppression, Goro said. When you leveled the great city of Defies the Void with mighty heart and endless perseverance, that was oppression. When you burned the forest of rainfalls from clear skies, that was oppression. When you...
That's enough, Kauri said. They get the point.
When it happened to you, Goro added with a menacing growl, it was justice.
Our people weren't even involved in the last human war, I said. We were a traveling fleet of ships. It was only when the war was over that we were captured and contained by the superiority. Also, that was a century ago, and...
It doesn't matter, Goro said. All humans are the same.
He pointed at Kauri.
You returned from Starsight, spouting ideals of democracy, and claiming we could make decisions together without our esteemed one who was not king. But then you skirt the will of the Senate, and seek to ally yourself with the enemies of the Den of Everlasting.
You're right, Kauri shouted. You're right. We should have had a vote about it first. But you have marched your clan in here and challenged the humans to a fight without bringing your grievance before the Senate. Even though your clan's representatives agreed that they would abide by Senate decisions.
Goro looked somewhat disgruntled at this point.
This is correct. But the invaders must be stopped immediately. So there is no time for...
We're not invading, FM reminded them.
Right, Kauri said. There is still time to consult the Senate and see if they are willing to hear the human offer of peace, or if they would prefer that your clan be permitted to prove them in trial by combat.
Kauri seemed to find this as ridiculous as I did, so maybe it wasn't a Kitson thing so much as a Goro thing. Kauri's ship, after all, had only an average number of destructors. I didn't agree to any trial, I said, by combat or otherwise.
Hush, FM said.
She said they're going to vote on it. We could at least wait to see how the vote turns out. Given the disaster that had resulted from the DDF trying to work with our own assembly, I wasn't eager to meet with another group of politicians. But we were looking for alliances, so we'd have to work within the Kitson governmental framework at any rate. Fine, I said.
Very well, Goro said. First, we will prepare a feast, and all may partake. Then, after the vote of the Senate, we will see who is right.
A feast? FM said to the kitson at my feet. That's good, right? Unless they mean to poison us. Goro's disc shot to the side, and he glared at FM.
Never would my clan participate in something so dishonorable, he shouted. Before you die, you will be staring down the glinting metal of my champion's blade.
FM said. Even she was starting to look unnerved. With that final outburst, Goro and his people marched back to their ship, their power armor leaving rows of tiny footprints in the sand. Kauri hunched a bit, clutching her hands together like she was trying very hard not to tell Goro exactly what she thought of him.
The feast is not a good thing, Kuna said. Their tradition is to dine first with those they wish to fight to the death. Over the meal, each will try to determine the weakness of the other. They consider it honorable.
I didn't like the implications of that. We're not going to fight them.
Hopefully you won't have to, Kauri said.
She flew her platform over while Goro and his people piled into their miniature battleship.
I think the Senate will see reason.
I'd like to see Cobb, I said, and Gran-Gran, the humans you found.
I can arrange that, Kauri said. If you will follow the swims upstream, we will take you to see your people.
Thank you, I said. Hana raised her fist to us, and Kauri and her people traveled across the sands again to their ship.
That was surreal, FM said.
I nodded. Not the welcome I expected to receive.
but they were taking us to Cobb. And none of my people had yet found themselves on the wrong end of a Kitson blade, glinting or otherwise. I supposed that meant we were doing okay.
Chapter 6. We flew along the shoreline and landed beside the swims upstream on another beach below the cliffs that sheltered the towering city of Dreamspring. The stone cliffs had clearly been worn over time into fins and ridges by the wind, the sandstones striped with hundreds of red-orange layers. I directed the flight to leave their Tanics in the boxes in their ships. The Kitson knew about hyperdrives, but I still didn't want to advertise that we had so many of them. I left Snuggles and Boomslug out of their box, but gave them a stern instruction to stay. I wanted at least one hyperdrive we could access in a hurry if things went wrong, so it was worth the risk that they'd disobey. I joined Cowrie, and my flight and the medtechs followed after us around a bend in the cliffside. The beach down the way was covered in Kitson, who appeared to be playing in the surf and relaxing on the sand, at least until they spotted us. We were giants to them, and I watched carefully where I stepped, not wanting to flatten any picnic spots. These Kitson were enjoying themselves, completely oblivious to the war with the superiority. We were interlopers, bringing the conflict with us. It was coming for them, regardless, but it still felt tragic to disturb the peace. I wondered what it was like to live that way, in a place where taking a trip to the beach to sit and enjoy yourself was an option on any given afternoon. The concept seemed alien, but stars, it must be nice. The Kitson gathered together, watching us. Some appeared frightened, others curious, but none attacked us. Cowrie floated out in front, waving both paws at the other Kitson. I wasn't sure exactly what that meant, but they seemed to believe she had us under control, because no one else came after us, demanding that we duel their champion to the death. We walked up a narrow path toward the city. No, it was a wide road to them. The path was lined with small, mound-shaped structures cut into the rock or formed out of intricately worked sandstone. The structures had arched doorways with tiny stone or metal doors affixed to them. Some had signs in a language I couldn't read, while others had little pots of flowers sitting on the doorsteps or in boxes hanging from circular windows.
"Saints and stars," Sadie said somewhere behind me. "This is so cute."
She wasn't wrong. It reminded me of a story my mother had told me when I was a child, about a man named Gulliver who traveled to a land full of little people who were wary of him because of his size. He befriended them, but was later kicked out when he doused a fire in the palace by peeing on it. As a child, I'd found that part of the story hilarious. Now I thought maybe the little people had a point. I shielded my eyes from the sun and looked up the hill at the mountainous city. As the road ascended, the little burrow structures began to pile up, dug into the walls of the cliff, or sculpted one on top of another into tiny hills with doors on all sides and at all levels. I wondered if they opened into tiny, multi-floored houses, or if each entrance went to a separate room isolated from the others. As we walked, little Kitson hover cars pulled over to the side of the road to allow us to pass. They chattered at each other, some too far away or faint for the pin to translate, though I did catch a few words.
"Humans returned.
Don't look threatening.
Can't trust them. Look how they Dione with them. Does that mean?"
I glanced back and found that Kimmelin had stopped, bent down beside what looked like a landscaping shop with barrels and stacks of bricks and ground covers, all organized by type. A Kitson waited out front, while two others used a large metal winch to load a huge decorative rock into the back of a hover truck. I couldn't hear what Kimmelin said. She didn't have a translator pin, so she wouldn't have been understood anyway. But then the Kitson stepped back, and Kimmelin lifted the rock, which was only half the size of her palm, but still enormous for the tiny creatures, and set it in the rear of the truck. One of them tipped its nose up at her, and I hoped that was a gesture of thanks. We didn't need to be accused of property damage or delivering insults.
The Kitsin we'd met so far didn't seem like they'd appreciate being condescended to.
Do you think she should be doing that? I asked FM.
She's not hurting anything, FM said. Kuna walked up behind us.
Compassion is universal, they said. It's seen in all cultures, though it is communicated differently.
FM sighed. I suppose there might be some cultural norm we're not aware of, but any of us could break one of those at any time and cause an interstellar incident.
Scud, our lives have gotten weird, I said.
That's the truth, Arturo said, following us up the road. It was simpler when we were fighting the Krell.
Simpler, but also stagnant. Our people had spent 80 years fighting for our lives, which meant we had very specialized skills. We were a well-oiled survival machine, but we lacked something these people had. It wasn't happiness, exactly. We had that, even if it was tempered by pain and fear. Prosperity, maybe. Peace. I wondered if this was what we would have seen on Redon, if we'd spent any time in their cities.
Kauri had drifted ahead of us a bit, and she hovered back, watching us.
Do you need to stop and rest? She asked. I'm sorry if I'm outpacing your human endurance.
Her shipmates were walking up the path on foot, and they seemed fine. They ran many steps to our one, but they didn't seem to be tiring. No, we're fine, I said. Just appreciating your beautiful city.
This used to be the home of Hesho, the most honorable and magnificent one who was not king. He died in the battle with the Delver at your planet.
She gave a little sigh.
We miss him. The superiority insisted that we needed to transition to a democracy in order to advance to primary citizenship, and I think that change was good for us. But I wish Lord Hesho had remained here with us to see the initiative of his people. He and his ancestors before him served us well for centuries.
Kauri continued to lead us up the path, and the pinnacles of the city of Dreamspring came into view. The cliff had been split into little vertical ridges, the effect uneven enough to be natural rather than Kitsin-made. The rock was full of holes and walkways, so the Kitsin could duck from tunnel to tunnel all across the cliff face of the upper city. The city only rose in height along the cliff face. In front, it opened into a sprawling urban landscape that filled the stone area between the sheer cliff and the sand of the beach. Here along the wall, our faces were even with the higher stories of pathways and tunnels.
Scud, we wouldn't fit in their buildings. We couldn't sit down in their homes with them or enter their shops.
I imagined what we would feel like on Detritus if ships full of 60-foot giants suddenly arrived. They'd be unable to fit in our elevators, unable to visit our caverns.
We'd be terrified.
It was a miracle that the Kitsin had welcomed the humans in the past, and those humans had taken advantage of their trust. That wasn't our fault, but we were responsible for overcoming that history now.
Kauri, I said, I know you need to speak to your Senate, but where will we even be able to meet with them?
Our Senate meets in a large auditorium, Kauri said. We can welcome you there, but you'll have to remain on the floor. I'm afraid we don't have any chairs that will accommodate you. We destroyed all the humans' dwellings after they were expelled from our planet in the Second Human War. Perhaps we could find some sturdy tables for you to sit on.
I worried about our ability to sit on even the sturdiest of Kitsin tables. Like FM said, we didn't want to cause any interstellar incidents.
We can sit on the ground, I said, if there's room.
As long as that wouldn't be too much of an insult, Kauri said. We wish to meet with you as equals, but we do not know your customs.
No, I said, no insults. Where exactly are Cobb and Gran-Gran?
They wouldn't have fit inside these buildings either. And if they were unconscious,
stars, they wouldn't fit inside a Kitsin hospital.
Our feasting grounds are just beyond the turn of the cliff, and the tent with your people is beyond those,
Kauri said.
We might be able to put up another tent large enough to shade you while you eat, but the first one took us quite a bit of effort to construct.
It's not necessary, I said. Please, take us to Cobb and Gran-Gran.
We took a narrow road across the clearing in front of the cliffs, the roads continuing to empty as we passed through. When we reached the other side of the city, the road turned toward the beach again, and Kauri presented the feasting grounds, which were basically a wide stretch of sand with stone tables and small gazebos set against the cliff. Some of Goro's people, I recognized them by their armor, were filleting fish as big as they were and loading them onto conveyors that rolled into ovens carved out of the cliff face.
Scud, I don't know if we can eat the food here, I said.
What are those things?
Alanique said, staring at the fish.
They look slimy.
Huh. They wouldn't have fish on Redon, I supposed. We had some that we raised in vats, and a few that lived wild in underground lakes.
Those are fish, Kuna said. They pull them from the ocean and eat them. You will be better off trying the fruit.
They gestured to the bowls and platters being laid out on the banquet tables.
It should be palatable to your people.
Alanique did not look thrilled, though she'd been polite about the food we'd given her on Detritus, despite most of it being made out of algae.
If you want to leave some of your people here, you may, Kauri said. The tent near the hospital is up ahead.
That sounds good, I said. I waved to Kel and Winnow, our med techs, to join us. I looked over at Alanique. The Kitsin seemed to react better to her, since she wasn't human. Come with me?
Of course, she said.
Do you want me to come? FM asked. No, I said. Stay here and maybe do some diplomacy. FM gave me a withering look. Kuna wandered over to the Kitsin, observing their cooking. I lowered my voice. Try to make sure Kuna doesn't insult them too much, I said, and that Ned doesn't volunteer to duel creatures one-tenth his size, all right?
I can try to make sure he doesn't volunteer again, FM said.
Good. I do not need that on my conscience. FM turned to the others and directed them out onto the beach. The burrow that Kauri said held the hospital was enormous, towering up into the air. There were many small doors into the complex itself, none of which an adult human could fit through. The Kitsin only needed a small fraction of the head clearance humans did. Kauri led us to a tent that had been erected out front. It looked like many smaller tents had all been affixed together on long poles, creating a structure perhaps 3 meters long by 2 meters wide. The roof was about the height of my shoulders, so when Kauri maneuvered her platform near the entrance and pulled back the tent flap, I had to stoop to look inside. There, on two platforms so low to the ground that I thought they might originally have been Kitsin banquet tables, lay Cobb and Grangran. Their bodies had been covered with many blankets layered over each limb and across their torsos. Kel and Winnow both ducked inside, and Kauri continued to hold the tent flap open as they examined Grangran and Cobb. They were both breathing, I was relieved to see, but their eyes were closed, and one side of Cobb's face was covered in bruises. Some medical equipment was attached to the side of the tables, and Kitsin, wearing little white robes and hats, were surveying it. One stood on a ladder that reached to about the height of my knee, changing out the tiny bottle on what looked like a makeshift IV pole. At least they were alive and had already received medical attention.
You'll want to get them home to your people, I imagine,
Kauri said. Yes, I said. We brought a medical transport ship, and our med techs will supervise the transfer. Alanique was watching them both with concern on her face, and she shook her head.
I'm still not sure that's Becca Nightshade.
I blinked. The person in the bed looked like Spence's grandmother. Why do you say that?
Because she isn't cytonic, Alanique said.
I reached out, trying to sense the vibration I always felt near another cytonic. I could feel waves of it rolling off Alanique. But she was right, nothing from Grangran. Farther out, I could feel Artanix still in our ships, but no other cytonics. But there was something, a vibration coming from the cliffs behind us. Not the concentrated frequency of a cytonic mind, but more like a cloud of something. Do you feel that? I asked. The strange buzzing from behind the cliffs? Alanique frowned. No, she said. I'm not finding any cytonic presence here.
That was odd, and I had no idea what it meant. I moved past Winnow to Gran-Gran's bed and brushed the blanket off her hand on one side and then the other, checking for hologram bracelets. There weren't any. And if the superiority were trying to trick us, where was the spring for the trap? I reached up and brushed Gran-Gran's hair with my hand. It moved exactly as I expected it to. I think that's her, I said. But you're right. Her cytonic abilities seem to be gone. What happened to them? And why did they end up here?
Gran-Gran was behaving strangely before she hyperjumped, Alanique said. She told me she could tell where Cobb was on the ship, which doesn't make sense. He's not cytonic, so she shouldn't have been able to find him through the negative realm.
That was strange. But you knew it was her then, I said, because you were familiar with her mind. So was I. She wasn't a superiority fake.
She also said she was hearing voices calling to her, asking her for help, Alanique said. She asked if they were my people.
I narrowed my eyes. That could have been the superiority interfering with her cytonics, like what happened to Spence's father. I looked at the med techs. What is their condition? They seem stable, Cal said.
We've focused on keeping them nourished and hydrated, Kauri added. Our lore keepers have some records of what nutrients your people need.
Kuna said that your people don't have cytonics, I said, but that you still have information about them.
Yes, Kauri said. Our lore keepers have preserved the records, and they study and understand them. But we have not had Kitsun cytonics for centuries. Some of my people believe it's a curse, that we haven't proven ourselves worthy to regain the powers.
That was unfortunate. Still, detailed records of cytonic powers would be useful. We would love to speak to your lore keepers, I said.
Of course, Kauri said. I will send a message saying that you've requested an audience with them.
In the meantime, we can load Cobb and Gran-Gran into the transport ship. Something strange was happening with Gran-Gran, possibly with both of them, and they needed better medical care than our med techs could give here in the field.
I think you should meet with our senators first, Kauri said. If you remove your people from the planet before the meeting, Goro may try to use that as evidence that you're trying to sneak away, or that you're preparing to attack.
I hesitated, looking to Winnow. I don't think a few hours are going to make a difference, Winnow said, unless their conditions worsen. That was fair. I looked at Cobb one more time. His face was pale, but he was breathing. He was alive. We'd wake him up. We had to. He had to find us a way out of this mess. Chapter 7. When we returned to the feast area, we found FM sitting cross-legged at one of the tables, rolling melons the size of her head through a machine with many coordinated blades that cut them into precise slices. Ned and Arturo sat behind her, loading citrus fruits onto small spindles that spun around a sharp blade, which removed the peel in a long, thin strip. Ned deposited the peels into very small waste canisters, which two Kitsun replaced with empty canisters and then scurried away to offer the full canisters to a pen filled with miniature goats, about the right size for a Kitsun to ride as a mount. Kimmelin and Sadie were seasoning fish with very small seasoning shakers, while Catnip and Teastall knelt next to the ovens, using handheld controls to remove the fish from the conveyors with acclivity-empowered spatulas.
I'm sorry, Kauri said to me. You are our guests. Your people shouldn't have been asked to prepare the food.
Hana ran up, sitting at my feet.
We didn't ask them, she said. They volunteered. In fact, FM insisted.
FM raised her eyebrows at me from across the sandy pavilion.
We take no offense, I said. Thank you for allowing us to serve you.
FM smiled.
This was kind of brilliant of her. We were trying to convince them that we weren't invaders.
I bet the humans who'd marched in and declared them a colony didn't offer to help them with food preparation.
What can I do to help? I asked. Alanik and I were brought to rotating spits where squashes roasted over a fire. We were instructed to use minuscule spray bottles to hydrate the turning vegetables with a brownish liquid that smelled both sweet and spicy. I sprayed a bit on my finger and tasted it. Stars, it was delicious. Not long after, Goro arrived. His champion rode on the saucer beside him, her sword tucked into a sheath and strapped across her back. Goro didn't look happy to see us all helping prepare the food. He gave me an especially affronted glare. I was supposed to be the enemy, the invader he was here to defeat. Putting FM in charge of diplomacy had clearly been the right decision. When we finished the food preparation, several kitsen carried away the remaining waste and cooking implements, and Kaori returned with another kitsen riding a second, smaller saucer.
"This is Juno," she told me, "one of our lore keepers. He has offered to dine with you, though he will wait until after the Senate meeting to impart knowledge."
"I am sorry this is necessary," Juno said, "but there are some among us who find our lore keeping to be superfluous or even threatening. It was only the will and continued patronage of the most honored one who was not king that sustained our order. We do not wish to go against the will of the Senate or attract the ire of
humans," Goro bellowed from the head of one of the large tables. "It is time to begin to feast. I will not offer you welcome. You come as invaders, and so we give you the greeting fit for those who dare think to conquer the den of everlasting light, which laps gently upon the shores of time. A full belly to make you sluggish, so that my champion may more easily pierce you with the sword."
"Well, that's disturbing," FM muttered beside me.
"At least he's upfront about it," Alanik added.
"Let us feast," Goro shouted, and the kitsen all echoed these last words with their fists raised in the air. I was beginning to wonder if I'd made a grave tactical error by dining with these creatures. I thought we were doing the right thing by being diplomatic and trying to prove we weren't here to conquer them. But now I worried they would discover some weakness they might use against us. "Juno," I said, as one of the kitsen brought me a small plate. It must have been an oversized serving platter to them, piled high with fish and nuts. "I know you don't want to share your knowledge with us until the Senate agrees to it, but may I ask if any of this food is poisonous to humans?"
"Certainly," Juno said. "The photophores of the flatfish are mildly venomous, but those have been removed. Our records show that humans ate most of our foods, and indeed put a great strain on our resources, trying to export some of our most prized delicacies for their own gain. To answer your question, the only foods we eat that would be poisonous to you are a few varieties of berry and some of our summer shellfish, and none of those have been offered to you this day. Make no mistake, Goro means to kill you, but he will only do so with Senate permission and in the way that is most advantageous to him."
Over at Goro's table, I heard him comparing his fish to a worthy foe slain in battle. That seemed like a stretch to me, but I'd once heard Spensa muttering something that sounded a lot like, "Fear the wrath of my very soft socks," on requisition day, so she probably would have approved. I wasn't sure how fighting one of us with a sword could be advantageous to him, but clearly he had some kind of endgame in mind. FM poked at her own fish, then took a bite. "This is delicious."
"Eh,"
Ned said, settling down cross-legged on the sand by Kimmelin.
"It's a little fishy."
FM blinked at him. "It is literally fish."
"Right," Ned said, "but fishy fish."
"Totally," Catnip said. "I hate it when my food adjective's its own noun."
"Exactly," Ned said.
"It's like the saint says," Kimmelin added. "You are what you eat."
"Hey, look," Sadie said. "There are boats out there." She pointed out onto the water, beyond the waves. The noise from the ocean was fainter this far up on the beach, and out on the blue-green expanse that seemed to go on and on forever until it melded with the sky. Scud. She was right. There were ships out there. Sailing vessels that couldn't have been much longer than a meter or two, bobbing up and down in the waves. I understand the basics of how boats work, I said. But how do they do that? How do they sail out there on all that water without worrying that it's going to swallow them up?
Sometimes it does, Juno said. The water is dangerous, especially for sailors who are caught in a sudden storm. As for how they brave it, how do you fly into the blackness of space? It seems just as unknowable to me, and a great deal more vast.
That was a really good point.
I don't know, Arturo said. You can't drown in space.
But you can asphyxiate, Ned said, which sounds just as unpleasant. The food suddenly felt heavy in my mouth. I set down my fork, which might have originally been some sort of gardening implement.
Or freeze to death, Catnip added. It's cold in space.
The ocean can be cold, Juno said, depending on the currents and the time of year.
You don't depressurize if you jump into the ocean, though, Ned said.
That scud sounds nasty. Did you know it can make your saliva boil in your mouth?
Ew, Ned, FM said. We're eating.
The superiority ship exploded before my eyes. The bodies of my parents were flung into space, fluids voiding, their eyeballs boiling. I shook my head and set down my plate. That hadn't happened. They'd been torn apart by the mind blades first. Hadn't they?
The ocean does the opposite, Juno said. The pressure in its depths is so great it can crush you.
Whoa, Ned said. That's awesome.
Stars, why did everything in the galaxy feel like it was trying to kill us?
I had started this conversation, but now I had to get away from it. Excuse me, I said, and I got up, leaving my food behind. I moved away from the city, down the beach, toward the water. A projectile shot over the ocean, and I flinched. Was the water attacking us now? But no, it was a bird, a whole flock of them, wings tucked against their bodies as they shot like bullets into the waves, and then flapping to give them lift again, carrying them into the air with fish in their mouths. Stars. I'd seen pictures of birds, but watching them glide over the water like so many starfighters. It was incredible, but it didn't stop my hands from shaking. I wiped cold sweat from my forehead. Scud, I'd walked away from the feast. Was I ruining our diplomatic relations? Offending the Kitson somehow? Would they perceive this as a threat? It didn't matter. I couldn't go back. I couldn't breathe. As I stared out at the ocean, the whole of it pressed down on me. All the weight of what felt like millions of miles of water bearing down on my body. It was too much.
Jorgen?
FM said. I wheeled around to find her watching me with concern. Scud, not concern. Anything but concern. I wished she'd look at me the way she had back on the platform on Redon, when she'd been pissed at me for telling her she shouldn't have liberated the slugs from detritus. She'd been so angry at me when I'd simply pointed out the obvious. She'd broken the chain of command, violated our orders, and put our comrades in danger.
You are not my flight leader, she'd said.
That had gutted me then, but I found it infinitely preferable to what I knew she was going to say now.
Are you okay?
I'm fine, I said.
Jorgen, FM said, you aren't fine.
Yes, I said, I am.
That's ridiculous. You can't be fine. Your parents,
this isn't the time, I said. We are in the middle of a diplomatic mission. We need to talk to the Senate so we can get Cobb and Gran-Gran home. Once we brought Cobb back, though, Stoff was definitely going to declare him indisposed. There was no avoiding that. In fact, according to protocol, I should have already told Stoff that we'd found Cobb and he was indeed unconscious. I didn't want to. As soon as I did, Stoff would be fully within his rights to start acting as admiral. I had no idea what he would do, but whatever it was, I didn't trust it.
Cobb knew what was best for the DDF, for our people, for Detritus. He should be the one in charge. He would get us through this. FM stared at me with her lips pressed together, like she was trying to hold in all the things she wanted to say.
This isn't about Cobb, she said finally. It's not about Gran Gran, and it's not about our diplomatic mission.
Exactly, I said. And those are the only things that matter right now.
That's not true, she said. You matter, Jorgen. What happened to you? It matters.
I balled my fists, turning away from her to look out at the sea. A particularly large wave washed up the beach, and I wished it would come all the way up and wash me out to sea and be done with it. I imagined the water pulling me down, crushing me the way Juno said it would, all that weight blocking out the questions, the demands, the needs of everyone else. Moments ago, all that water had seemed terrifying. Now it felt like release.
Jorgen, FM said, you need to talk to someone. It doesn't have to be me, but have you said anything about your parents to anyone?
I hadn't. I couldn't. Not until I knew everyone was safe. We need to be prepping for the Senate meeting, I said. Go ask Kaori what we can do to support her in convincing the Senate we're here in peace.
I don't think...
Do it, FM. Jorgen, that's an order. I looked back at her, and she stared at me. There was some anger there now, and that was good. Much better than pity. For a moment, I thought she was going to tell me off again. Announce that I wasn't her flight leader, and I couldn't tell her what to do. Say what we both knew. That I was only pretending to be in control. That I'd never known what I was doing. That I was incompetent to be in command, and that I was failing at everything. Even this.
Fine,
FM said, and she spun around and marched back up the beach. Past her, I could see that the rest of the flight had finished eating. Kaori escorted them down to the water, where Ned and Kimmelin took off their shoes and rolled up their jumpsuits, letting the water wash over their feet. Alanik and Arturo sat in the sand, laughing. I couldn't remember what it felt like to laugh. I wondered if that meant I had already drowned. Chapter 8. I was still on edge when Kaori led us to the Senate Assembly, held in an arena built into the cliffside. The arena was an enormous space for the Kitsun, containing hundreds upon hundreds of small padded seats carved into the sandstone, ascending up to the ceiling at the back of the room. There was barely space for Alanik to stand, and I had to hunch my shoulders to avoid scraping my head. The floor at the bottom of the seats provided enough space for a few of us to sit. The others stayed on the beach, while FM, Alanik, and I all tried to squeeze in together. We'd used the lack of space to leave Kuna out of the meeting, but in reality, I was afraid of what they might say. We had to sit with our knees tucked up to our chests to fit all three of us. A kitsun floated on a small platform with a raised wall around it, like a cup we might drink out of on Detritus. The cup had a microphone attached to the front of it, like on a podium.
I am Adi, Director of the Senate, the kitsun said. It is my job to ensure that the proceedings progress in an orderly fashion. You will not speak unless you are asked a direct question.
Will we be given an opportunity to plead our case? I asked. We're trying to retrieve our friends and offer an alliance. And if we aren't allowed to speak...
You may be called upon to speak if there are questions, Adi said. Please do not speak out of turn.
We may be. Stars. I hoped Kaori had this under control. The Kitsun senators began to file in, all wearing silk robes of a similar style. The colors varied widely, and I wondered if they were based on personal preference or if they indicated what region the Kitsun was from. We'd landed on this island, but we'd passed over hundreds more. As the hall began to fill, I noticed physical differences in the Kitsun as well. Some had longer ears and smaller snouts, while others had darker coloring to their fur. A pair in the back each had an ear notched as if ceremonially cut, and one that took a seat toward the front had a row of silver earrings pierced all the way up to the tip on one side. That's a lot of Kitson, FM whispered beside me. Are you going to do the talking if there are questions?
I appointed you our diplomatic specialist, I said. You should do it.
FM took a deep breath.
Okay, but if I say something wrong, I'm a little afraid Goro's champion is going to run me through with a sword. It's not easy to get in and out of here. We wouldn't be able to escape.
I'll talk if neither of you wants to, Alanik said.
No, FM said. I can do it, but...
Goro arrived, riding on his disc with his champion beside him. He'd left the rest of his entourage outside. The champion's sword was still sheathed, and I hoped it would remain so. Goro lowered his platform to be even with the bottom row of chairs, presumably so he wouldn't block the view of any of the senators. This put him alarmingly close to Alanik's knees, but she didn't seem intimidated by him. It was hard to be intimidated by something so small, but that didn't mean I wanted his champion charging our ankles with a sword. Diplomatic disaster or not, someone could get seriously hurt, and it could be one of us. Adi called the meeting to order. Only about a third of the Senate seats were filled, but I imagined there were probably senators who were away or who hadn't been able to gather on such short notice. A lot of the Kitson were watching us suspiciously, but none of them were advancing on us with weapons drawn, so this was still an improvement. Until they started to speak. Adi gave both Goro and Kaori the floor, which surprised me. I'd sat through enough boring assembly speeches that I expected this meeting to be much the same. But instead, Goro and Kaori entered into a sort of debate.
These human invaders, Goro said, must be dealt with. Given our long and violent history with them, we know what language the giants speak. They must receive the only communication they understand, a swift and violent lesson by combat. Their kind has brought only ruin upon our shores, and it is up to us to visit vengeance upon all our enemies.
FM leaned over and whispered to me.
He says violence is the only language we speak, but he's the one who keeps trying to attack us.
That was an interesting argument. I wanted to hear more, but it was apparently Kaori's turn.
The humans aren't our enemies, Kaori said. They have come by my invitation to collect their friends who arrived here by accident and who are even now receiving medical treatment. They also bring with them a promise of an alliance, which they have already established with the Urdale.
Most of the audience eyed Alanik, and Alanik stared back at them, stone-faced. She wasn't any better with people than I was, but at least she didn't go around referring to them as lesser. She leaned over to me.
You could just fight him, Alanik said. He is literally asking for it. Any of us could beat him in combat.
If we do that, FM said, we'll only solidify their image of us as dangerous, violent, and aggressive. All the things we're trying to prove we aren't. Besides, the Kitson were fast and trained in dueling. I wouldn't put it past them to get a good blow in on one of us and seriously injure us. I doubted they'd manage to kill us, but I didn't want any of it on my conscience. If Spencer were here, she would have seen it differently. She would have dueled the Kitson and probably won spectacularly, and would have somehow spun that victory into an alliance. But she wasn't here, and I was doing the best I could.
Of course they say they come in peace, Goro said, but we all know what humans are like.
I don't think we do, Kaori said. Humans invaded us in the past, but these humans have a common enemy in the superiority. I was there when Winzik summoned a Delver to destroy the humans.
It was in that battle that we lost our most honored and revered one who was not king.